The Exchange Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England. Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Since the Great Recession officially ended in 2009, the U.S. has seen significant upswings in the housing market, the stock market, and the labor market. One exception, however, has been the number of women participating in the workforce, which has steadily dropped in recent years. In fact, this trend was already well underway before the economic meltdown, and that has many people pondering the possible causes and effects of fewer women working. Today in The Exchange, a look into the social, economic, and policy factors that contribute to fewer women in the paid workforce. Let's hear from you. Why do you think we're seeing a decline in American women working outside the home? Are they opting out or are they pushed out by policies that make it hard to work and have a family? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. With me in studio, Mary Jo Brown, chair of the New Hampshire Women's Foundation and founder and president of Brown & Company Design, based in Portsmouth. And Mary Jo Brown, nice to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
Joining us on the phone from New York, Pamela Stone, professor of sociology at Hunter College and the City University of New York. Her research focuses on women in the workforce. Pamela's book is called Opting Out, Why Women Really Quit Careers and Head Home. Pamela Stone, great to have you. Thank you also for being here.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Pamela, just crunching the numbers for a little bit, when we talk about declining female workforce participation, what does that mean?
Well, the labor force participation rate is kind of a key economic indicator. And what it, how it's calculated is we take the so-called civilian workforce, typically 18 to 64 years old, so we're eliminating people in the military, eliminating people who are in institutions for whatever reason. We're saying of that group, what percentage are at work working last week and what percentage are actively looking for work? So the labor force participation rate is both people who are working with a job or typically with a job or people who are actively, you know, seeking a job.
And what are the trends that we're seeing, Pamela, in terms of women in that labor
force
participation?
Right. Well, as you previewed, I mean, what happened to women after World War II, of course, was we saw this rapid ascent in their labor force participation. What starts happening in the mid-90s is that rate of increase slows, and we start seeing a plateauing, really, of women's labor force participation. Still at quite a high rate, you know, in the high 50s and in the low 60s, so still at quite a high rate, but nonetheless, we've stopped that ascent that we've been seeing for so many decades. And you're right that after the 2008 recession, we even see a little bit of a drop in women's labor force participation. But so after, I guess the biggest point here is that after a long ascent, we start seeing a stabilization and a slight drop post-2008.
And we're going to talk a lot, of course, about, you know, why this happens,
right,
how it happens. But before we get into that, here's the question, and I'll throw this to you first, Mary Jo. You know, when you see reporting on this dip in labor force participation, but it's steady, it's often portrayed as a worrisome phenomenon. You know, this is a bad thing. Can we really say that this is a net positive or a net negative for families, for society, for the economy, to have fewer women in the paid workforce? Can we really judge this?
Well, as we were talking about the numbers earlier, one thing I'd like everyone to understand is that New Hampshire isn't necessarily in line with what we're seeing with the USA numbers. So typically, New Hampshire has had a higher percentage of women in the workforce, and that's been consistent over many years. I also think it's important to look at the bigger picture. So if we think about centuries ago, ultimately, there's been a huge shift. Say you compare 1965 to now. Obviously, there's a lot more women in the workforce. So while there may be a dip or a slight decline. I think some of the issues we're talking about today are incredibly important, primarily because there are more women in the workforce than there have been historically. And I'd love to know some of those New Hampshire numbers more specifically, primarily because I know that sometimes the New Hampshire numbers are not in sync with what we see as the USA figures.
How do both of you feel? And again, I'll turn to you first, Mary Jo. But again, when this is talked about, you know, it's shown as this is a bad thing. We should worry about this. Should we?
Well, I think we talk a lot about choice. So when we hear the word opt out, you know, and we hear lots of words around this, don't we? Lean in, lean out. Harvard says raise your hand. Don't be on the mommy track. I think ultimately when we're talking about women in the workforce, we want to understand if they're there because or if they're not there because of a choice or because they are being pushed out. Because of that, I think Pam's book is incredibly relevant today, so we can understand whether or not the working environment we're creating is conducive for women who do want to work.
Well, and Pamela, I should let everybody know the title of your book, Opting Out, is a question mark. I have seen some reporting lately on this sort of opting out or pushed out by, again, policies that just make it too tough or make it not financially manageable. But before we get to that, so how do we judge this? I mean, again, is this a net positive, a net negative?
I think sort of from a macroeconomic perspective, it's kind of a net negative. I mean, we have an aging population. There's a sense that we need more workers, not fewer workers in the economy. So when we see, people who are in prime work age, women, you know, deciding not to work, you know, it does raise some questions about whether we're making sort of maximum use of our sort of talent pool. But I think another thing that's really important to point out is that this is not unique to women. Men's labor force participation is falling, too. We're seeing this across the board. So there's something that's pulling people out of the labor force. And it appears to be that so the major culprits, when we look at this in terms of trying to think why do we see this overall decline in labor force participation, seems to be kind of structural issues, not so much the kind of choice issues, which are important, don't get me wrong, but not those don't appear to be the dominant factors at work right now. So what's driving the decline in labor force participation for men and women right now appears to be, number one, the aging of the population. We are the baby boomer. I'm a baby boomer. Baby boomers make up a huge number of our population and of our labor force. And as they age, all workers, whatever, even though more older workers are working more than ever today, the reality is older workers work less. So the aging of the population is part of the decline in the labor force participation rate. And the other part of it, of course, the other major factor is the 2008 recession, which we're still recovering from. And employment always shows a reaction to economic cycles and downturns. So those two things, which are really not individual control kinds of issues, you know, the aging of the population, the larger economy, those are things we think of as structural issues. Those are really driving a big dip, a big portion of the dip that we're seeing. So I think it's important to have that context.
So it's big macroeconomic factors,
too. That's not to say there aren't other things, and we should talk about what some of those other things are. But I definitely think that we need to keep in mind that it's not necessarily the storyline that is often trumpeted in the media about it's all about women turning their backs on work, for example.
Again, the number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Let's hear from you. Why do you think we're seeing this slight but steady decline in American women working outside the home? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. So, Pamela, you hit on something that I want to ask both of you about. So I'll ask you first, the storyline that we hear in the media about this. So what's the storyline?
Well, I think the storyline often is very much about individual women's choice. And I think there, frankly, is often a kind of a snarky element to that storyline, that women thought they could have it all. Look, you can't have it all, or you don't want to have it all. And when we're talking about having it all, we're simply talking about having a family and a job. We're not talking about all that much in many ways. So I think there is that. I think there's a kind of gotcha element to the media that when we see, particularly the women who are portrayed as opting out, who tend to be upper middle class professionals, women who are sort of poised to succeed and do well in sort of professional careers. I think there's a kind of, as I said, kind of a gotcha element when those women decide to take some time out from those careers. So I think there's a kind of pitting of women against women too. I think we know that we still haven't, despite, as Mary Jo says, women have been working a very long time, and this is very much the norm. We still have, I think, as a culture, a tendency to pit women's choices against one another, women who decide to take some time out versus those who decide to continue working, that kind of thing. So I think oftentimes the media picks up on and sort of fans those flames.
What do you think? What's the storyline now, Mary Jo? And what's the real story?
Yeah, so I think a lot of what we hear about at the New Hampshire Women's Foundation, and we actually dedicated one of our Gender Matters publications to this, is understanding work-life balance better. And one of my favorite infographic charts to look at is the typical week for mothers and fathers and how that compares from 1965 to now. So in the chart, it shows that fathers are actually working a little less, 42 hours down to 37. Mothers are working a lot more, 8 hours to 21 hours. There's a lot less housework being done. So the moms went from 32 to 18. Hooray for the dads. They went from 4 to 10. But they're still not matching the amount of housework that the mothers are doing. And then you see that the child care has now actually slowed. There's less child care hours by both parents. There's increased child care hours by dads. So our typical or stereotyped gender roles that men and women play in the family unit are changing. And even though we see some shifts, we're still really talking a lot about how to balance all of those things. And I think that what we see in the media is how hard it is to balance all of those things and how families need to be creative and how it's hard for them, whether or not we need policies to help with creating that balance, whether or not we need companies to create better family-friendly work environments. But looking at those work weeks, the typical week for moms and dads and families has been really interesting for me in understanding the bigger picture.
You know, it's interesting. We've talked forever about family-friendly workplaces. Mary Jo, we probably talked to you about that 15 years ago, and yet you do still hear about the struggles, about some women just leaving their jobs because it's just too difficult to make it all click. So what's happening on the employer side?
Yeah, so and obviously business is a critical partner in making that happen, and there needs to be an economic advantage for the businesses to fully appreciate the desire to create a family-friendly work environment. First of all, let me say that the New Hampshire Women's Foundation has elected the family-friendly workplace as our key priority for the next 2 years. So that decision was just made recently. We're very excited because we're going to be developing a couple years of programming around that. And we're looking forward to learning more about the subject by collecting examples of best practices in the state. We hope to reach out to businesses who can share those stories with us, employees who have seen not great practices and great practices. But a family-friendly workplace can be created through many ways. So one, yes, policy can create that. There's a lot of talk about paid leave. Josh Leves and his national conversation around paternity leave, paid leave, any type of leave, vacation, medical leave, paid leave, maternity, paternity. But then there are a lot of other benefits that don't often get put into the conversation, such as flex time, job sharing. We can talk more about those other creative
Definitely have to talk about it from the employer end, because it can be, you know, tricky for employers to balance it all out. We're going to take a very quick break. And when we come back, we'll hear from you. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Checking in now very quickly with our summer car raffle. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at the slight but steady decline in the number of American women in the paid workforce. We invite you to join us, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Why do you think we're seeing a drop in American women working outside the home? Are they opting out or are they pushed out by policies that discourage having work and family? Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Mary Jo Brown, Pamela Stone, I want to go to our listeners. But before we do, Pamela, I'd love to hear from you, too, on what we were talking about just before the break. We've talked about family-friendly workplaces forever, but what are we seeing in reality?
Well, I think one of the sort of aftermaths of the 2008 recession is some of the research is suggesting that we're seeing employers pull away from that a bit. that people are, you know, that employers are not as likely to make demands for those kinds of accommodations because they feel that employment is insecure and precarious, and employers don't feel the need to offer it because of the same reasons, because employment is precarious and insecure. So that's a little bit of a sort of regression compared to what we were seeing. I think the policies were a little bit more high visibility pre-2008. But I think what Mary Jo points out is so important, the whole nexus of work and family, because I think there's no question that some of the things that we're seeing retard women's labor force participation is, for example, the lack of affordable and high-quality child care, you know, where the United States is woefully inadequate on that front compared to other countries. At the same time, while men are doing a lot more of that, women still take up the bulk of child care and other kinds of caregiving. So with an aging population, we're also seeing women pick up more caregiving for aging parents, for example, and that, too, exercises a pull away from labor force participation. The other thing that I wanted to point out on that front is that we've had the steady increase until very recently in women's labor force participation, working families, you know, both partners working. But the world of work has actually become more hostile over time. So we have two trends that I think are, you know.
What do you mean by hostile? Hostile towards who?
Hostile towards the workers in terms of time and schedule, in terms of the very issues we're trying to figure out. You know, how do you make work and family? How do you sort of articulate those two? So at the low end of the wage spectrum, what we're seeing is more and more kind of what's called scheduling on demand. So schedules are incredibly unpredictable. Workers in retail sectors, for example, are sometimes getting their schedules just a few days before, you know, they're due to work, and the schedules change from week to week to accommodate the business flow and the business patterns, making it virtually impossible to get any kind of stable or steady child care, for example. So we're seeing more of that with the low-wage workers, this unpredictable work. And at the upper end, professional and managerial work, we've been seeing for some time now an uptick in the number of hours. So we see those jobs are getting longer and longer in terms of hours, longer and longer in terms of 24/7 accountability. People are tethered to their smartphones, for example. So on sort of both ends of the wage spectrum, you're seeing some changes in the way work is being organized and the scheduling of work that's making it just that much harder for working families to schedule work and family.
Well, and on the employer accommodations or workforce accommodations, from the employer's perspective, Pamela, you know, why should I give this one worker an accommodation, a flexible schedule,
right,
whatever, when
right.
the other single guy
well,
or
I mean,
gal
that,
doesn't have it?
Yeah.
You know, there's some resentment
yeah.
and there's
right.
also sort of we want to treat everybody fairly.
Well, there's no question still that this is too often seen as just a working mom's accommodation and a special favor. And I think what we need to do is broaden that whole thinking out to there are a lot of workers, parents and non-parents, who want these kinds of accommodations and who need these kinds of, you know, humane working schedules. So it's not just a working mom's issue, number one. And to the extent that you sort of ghettoize it as a working mom's issue, I think we know we undermine and we stigmatize it. We haven't as a culture, as a workplace culture, really accepted these kinds of accommodations as widely as they have, for example, in European countries. We have a lot of work to do. The business case, and Mary Jo can probably speak this better than I, but the business case in terms of the research has been made time after time that you have more satisfied workers, you have more productive workers. But despite the business case, many employers still seem to be loath to extend these kinds of, you know, accommodations. They do it on a very stingy one-by-one basis. And when they do it like that, when just one worker, for example, gets picked out as being sort of the beneficiary of, say, a flexible schedule, that, of course, breeds resentment and discontent among other workers.
Okay, and I can see
so
you want to, yeah.
I know, I have one quick comment to add, and I really agree, Pam. I think it's important to know that millennials, that younger generations, expect these type of work environments.
Yes.
They demand them.
Young men and young women.
Young women and
yes.
young men.
Yes.
And I think that talent attraction and retention is a really important subject for us to think about.
Okay. Well, again,
yeah.
lots
yeah,
of folks
I,
who
I
want
totally
to jump
agree.
In. Our number on the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Give us your thoughts. Tell us your stories on this issue of more American women deciding not to work outside the home. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Peter's in Durham. Hi, Peter. Go ahead. You're in the exchange.
Hi. I agree very much with the things that Pat was saying. I think that she's right on with her analysis. But I work with a lot of women and who are choosing whether or not to be in the workforce. And the thing that it seems pretty clear to me is that the lack of affordable childcare and low wages contribute, they make it a bad deal for women to be in the workforce. You know, and if the minimum wage had been correctly, properly adjusted for just inflation, it would be about $15 an hour right now. And so you could go to work at McDonald's making $15 an hour, which, and there's a movement for the fight for 15 nationwide right now. But and that is what a teacher I talked to yesterday who's running a summer camp, that's what she's being paid to direct a summer camp. So what kind of a choice is that for a person, like to make, to be at work and you spend all of your money on child care when the child care that you're getting may not be very good because the child care agencies can't pay their employees very much, and so they get people who end up, you know, not being maybe the people you want taking care of your kids.
Right. Peter, getting right down to the numbers and weighing that economic calculation. And following up on Peter, here's a Facebook comment from Jennifer who says, I can speak for myself and say that after having children, childcare expenses outweighed my salary. Jennifer says, there's simply not enough support for working mothers. What about that, Pamela?
Well, that's absolutely right. And one of the things we know is just as we've seen a sort of a plateauing in women's labor force participation, we've seen a stagnation in closing the wage gap. So the wage gap is pretty much locked in for, you know, now. It's not closing. We're not seeing any movement in it. So women are typically earning, you know, about 80 cents. I forget, Mary Jo, you might know the most recent number, but women are earning about 80 cents to every dollar earned by men. So every worker makes the calculus, is it worth going to work? Does it cost more to work than it does that I'm going to earn? And for women, that calculus is that much tighter because they're not being paid, and there's a lot of research that shows they're not being paid what they're worth. So to the extent that we have wage discrimination that's targeting women, we're making it much harder for them to go to work because we're not covering, just as your caller just so well described, we're just not able to make it, they can't cover their costs.
Mary Jo, go ahead.
Peter, I was so excited to hear your call because you're bringing up three really important subjects around a family-friendly workplace. One, child care. For the New Hampshire perspective, we're with 15th most expensive state for child care. And it is expensive. We all know it's expensive. But
On the other hand, we're a relatively wealthy state.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. Two, minimum wage. You know, this state can't even agree that it wants to have one, never mind setting a number. And I think that it's important to note that in New Hampshire, 66% of the minimum wage workers are women. So it disproportionately affects women in our state here. And third, wage gap is a subject near and dear to the Women's Foundation, something that we know a lot about. And yes, you were right. Nationally, it's in the 80s. In New Hampshire, we're below the national average. So, in fact, the gap is a little bit higher at 77 cents. This is a subject that's often misunderstood because it can contain many different facets. No matter how you slice or dice the data, even if you're looking at the same job, the same occupation, or if you're comparing all jobs, a gap still exists. And it's not just women who are affected. If they're part of a family, that's the family wallet that's affected. So
we shouldn't call this the gap between men and women. We should call it the family gap? Is that what you're saying?
Well, no. What I'm saying is that because women are paid less and they bring those dollars home, you know, we now know that 4 in 10 households, women are the primary breadwinner. So if they're not being paid equally to men, then, in fact, that really does affect their family budget.
And we've done many hours on this whole wage gap thing. So I'm not going to go into it now. But there are questions about it, right, Mary Jo, that, you know, how valid a comparison it is. Men and women choose different careers. Women take time out to raise children. Women tend to work part-time. So
there's a lot of questions about
how real it is.
I promise I won't go on and on about it. So like I was saying, there are many different ways to slice and dice the statistics. But take construction, where there's very little gap in pay, so 95%, 3% of women in New Hampshire work in the construction field. So you're right. There aren't that many women picking that field. It happens to be a field where there is more equal pay. But no matter how you slice and dice it, whether it's a large gap or a small gap, it still exists.
Yeah, I want to just underscore that even when you're comparing very closely, you still see a wage gap. And it tends to open up when women are in their late 20s, when they start having children. So you start seeing it, you know, exactly when you'd expect to see it, when they start having kids.
And
whether or not they take time out from work,
yeah,
just having children, for example.
And I don't think we can minimize the impact of that in understanding why women will or will not be in the workforce.
Go ahead. You look like you want to say a little bit more there.
Well, I do think that as we move forward, it will be great for college students to understand the ramifications of their career choices. So, yes, a woman may say, I'd like to be a teacher. That's what I prefer to be. But in fact, I hope we can educate both women and men in understanding what the salary ranges are for that profession versus if we're trying to encourage more women to go into the STEM fields, there may be a greater opportunity for a higher income. And I'm not suggesting that income is the only measure of success here. We have to start thinking about what we want in our lives and have as much information as we need to make careful decisions as we build our lives.
Again, our phone number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Here's an email from Adrian who says, I'm so happy to hear you using the words outside the home. There are a lot of us to stay home with our kids. We are interested in this topic, and hearing you use that phrase is validating and powerful. Wow. Pam, let's talk about that a little bit. You have to tread very carefully, you know, to say women who don't work, well, they're working. They're very busy. In fact, sometimes some women who work say, you know, they enjoy being at work because people listen to them and they don't have to, you know, sweep up spilled oatmeal all day long. So thank you, Adrian. We really are trying to be real careful in how we approach this. But I'd love to hear from you, too, on that, Pamela. You've written about this and the language is important.
Yeah, it is important. You know, we have this great, on the one hand, we seem to have this great cultural valuation of motherhood. On the other hand, we devalue motherhood tremendously. And so you'll hear when the interviews that I did with women who had so-called opted out, who were, these were professional women who had taken some time out of their career when I was talking to them. And to a woman, they told me about whenever they'd meet a new person, the person would find out that they were just a mom or a stay-at-home mom, that they'd basically turn on their heel and stop talking to them. So we have a real cultural kind of ambiguity around these stay-at-home moms that they do appear to be oftentimes devalued, despite our saying, you know, quite the opposite. So it's a real problem.
The New Hampshire Women's Foundation has run a series of listening sessions with approximately 500 people over the last 3 years. And I want to reiterate that we see some of these antidotes, these stories, as really putting a magnifying glass on what Pam is talking about. So you would be surprised in these very private sessions to hear people talk about the guilt that they feel. You would be surprised the judgment that we see. The dad that comes in and says, I'm a stay-at-home dad, and the moms at the park will not talk to me. The mom that sits around the table and says, when I say it's time that I have to leave and go to my child's soccer game, I'm made to feel very guilty that I'm leaving the meeting. And then the mom, the woman who elected not to be a mom say, well, guess what? I feel angry when you are leaving the meeting to go to your kid's soccer game.
That's the resentment in the workforce that I mentioned earlier.
So I really would say that because we see roles changing, there's a lot of guilt. And there is a lot of judgment.
Cultural discomfort.
Yes.
If I could put it that way.
That's a better phrase.
Let me take a quick break here, and then we'll talk some more. We're going to check in now with our summer car raffle. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, fewer American women in the paid workforce. Why that's the case and how we assess it. You can join us 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. We have two guests for the hour, Pamela Stone, professor of sociology at Hunter College and the City University of New York. Her book is called Opting Out, Why Women Really Quit Careers and Head Home. Mary Jo Brown's in studio, chair of the New Hampshire Women's Foundation and founder and president of Brown & Company Design, based in Portsmouth. Again, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. And both of you, let's go to Karen and Beau. Hi, Karen. Go ahead. You're in the exchange.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
I wonder if this is a related question. Well, it's a curiosity, I should say. I'm Australian, and I know that this percentage of women not having children in Australia is in excess of about 26%. But I was researching that a few weeks ago, and the 2004 census said that almost half of the women between the ages of 15 and 44 in America don't have children, and that's an increase from 46.5% in 2012 to 47.6% in 2013. So I guess the question is, if they're not in the workforce and they're not at home, where are they?
So, and a lot of numbers there, Karen. So just to make sure I hear you right, the decline in women in the workforce partly is women who don't have children.
Yeah, because if they're not staying at home, the stay-at-home moms,
right,
and they're not in the workforce, I wonder, you know, because the reason that I hear you're saying is that they're not stay-at-home moms, right? Sorry, they're not in the workforce for the stay-at-home moms,
right.
But there's a large number of women, almost 47% of women that don't have children.
And they're not participating in the workforce. Wow, yes.
I don't know if that's a statistic or not. I'm not sure that's the statistic. I think there's some overlap. I mean, there's no question that women without children are more likely to be working than those who have children. And certainly there's no question, too, that age range that you gave is fairly broad, so some of that group of women will eventually have children because women are deferring childbearing quite noticeably. So there's no question, I think, that what that points out, it's always a very interesting statistic because it points out that women on both the labor force front and the family front are kind of caught between a rock and a hard place, and we're making it so difficult for women for whom working is really now to be expected life activity. We're making it so hard for them to articulate these two activities. So women are holding off or they're not having children entirely, in part because of the fact that it's so difficult to combine work with family.
And Pamela, I have read that, and I'm glad to hear from someone from another country. Thank you,
yeah,
Karen, for that call, because I have heard that in many European countries, the female participation rate in the outside the home labor force is higher because it's easier. The policies are easier. On the other hand, I have heard that women, this is some reading from, you know, great sources, New York Times, Pew, Washington Post, and so forth, that women in Europe don't tend to advance as much, that you have fewer women managers, that they sort of get stuck in these lower wage part-time jobs. So I just wonder if you can help us sort that out, Pamela.
Well, I do think historically you have a tradition in Europe of being of women working much more at a part-time rate than you see in the United States. In the United States, the majority of women work full-time. So you do have that. You also have a history of women being shunted into highly female segregated jobs, which you certainly have in the United States, but that's one of the sort of post-feminist revolution changes, is that we've seen so many women move into non-female dominated jobs. You haven't seen that to quite the extent that you've seen it, you know, you've seen that much more here than you have in Europe, for example. So you do have what appear to be some kind of cultural backlogs in these European countries, that despite having some family-friendly and supportive policies, the fact that women are more concentrated in part-time work obviously makes a difference to their earnings and their advancement. The fact that they're more concentrated in female-dominated jobs means that they don't have access to leadership positions. And the fact that in many of these countries they support fairly long parental leaves, that's another sort of career interruption. Women can get back to work, but again, it exacts a toll on their advancement. So things are changing over there, but you're absolutely right. You can have this coexistence of more inequality, so to speak, at the same time that you have higher labor force participation because of the nature of the labor force participation compared to ours in the U.S.
Mary Jo, go ahead.
You know, I had a quick note on a cultural shift, which is the Pew came out with some great research a couple of years ago about graduating women, and that for the first time they saw them prioritizing career and money over having children, which is just fascinating to me. But that's a quick side note. When we're talking about paid leave, I think it's important for all of the listeners to understand the U.S. is the only,
oh, <yes.
laughs> you know, we stand alone in not having any paid leave. And ultimately, even though three states in the USA, so it's California, New Jersey, and Rhode Island, have put in some paid leave policies, we look to the California one as a great example. It was put in place in 2004, and the impact, and it's, I guess it's 6 weeks partially paid, and it's a family paid leave policy.
So dads and moms.
Dads and moms.
And aging parents.
And it can be for elder care, right. Mm-hmm. So it can be for elder care. And the impact of that was that it doubled the participation of both women and men in leveraging that policy. But it the increase in people stayed at work. It was an incredible benefit to worker retention, ultimately.
Well, I read a story just this morning, I think, about a mom who had a child, decided to drop out because she didn't have that that maternity leave, and she just couldn't stand the idea of putting her infant in daycare. She said, I would have put a 1-year-old in, or maybe even an 8-month-old, but not an infant. And so she just said, forget it. So that's an example of what you're talking about.
Yeah, and this is an important conversation that we will be having with Josh Levs in September with his book All In and Paid Leave.
All right, let's take another call. No, and this
just,
is
just to underscore that point, that the experience with paid leave shows that it supports employment. It doesn't result in women dropping out or staying out.
It's the opposite.
Yeah.
Let's take Ellen in Concord. Hi, Ellen. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning.
Morning.
Really fascinating conversation. And I'd like to add a point that expands the discussion beyond the mommy wars to help us all remember that paid sick and medical leave benefits everyone. It benefits those who are caring for aging parents, for spouses who might be ill, or for ourselves if we're undergoing a severe medical condition. So I think tightly connecting paid sick leave with the ability to and family leave to just caring for children does a real disservice to the broader conversation.
Okay. Ellen, thank you very much for calling in. And here's a Facebook comment from Paula who says, I'm so happy you're discussing this subject. After being a, quote, stay-at-home mom for 13 years, I'm hoping to re-enter the workforce. When updating my resume, I realized that I've been extremely busy and engaged over the years but did not get paid for this work. Paula says, I feel we judge the work that parents do by the monetary gain to the family. It is very difficult to estimate the social and emotional benefit to the family when a parent can stay at home. One of my children has a chronic health condition, and honestly, sometimes I know I could not have held a job when she had health issues. Maybe I'm generalizing, Paula says, but I feel that when a parent stays at home to manage a family, there is very little, quote, status with this job. So much to this email, including the value of staying at home. And we talked about that a little bit earlier. You know, we shouldn't just judge this on pure, raw economic grounds. But let's pick up, if we could, Pamela, on the other point Paula makes, that she's hoping to re-enter the workforce, but, you know, realizing that her resume may not look conventional.
Yes. And I've been studying, actually, the women that I studied for the opting out book, I've actually followed those women up and looking at their efforts to get back in the labor force. Most of them have tried to do so, and most have been successful. What's very clear is she has to take, women at home have typically, like it sounds like Paula does, they typically have some significant volunteer experience, a lot of household management tasks as well, and they really need to find a way to translate that, especially their volunteer experience, their unpaid volunteer experience, into sort of work equivalent type task responsibilities, translate those so that an employer understands the kinds of skills they've been using and building while they've been away from the workplace. And I think what we're seeing is that more and more employers are being understanding of that. They're understanding that women, especially women, you know, are taking time out, especially in her situation where she had a child with health needs. I think employers are more tolerant of that than they used to be. I think, you know, somebody who has otherwise a good resume and has good education and credentials is going to be an attractive worker. I think the other thing they need to do is the key thing right now is technology. So what most women who are seeking to reenter are finding themselves kind of unconfident about is their mastery of sort of email, of social media, things like that. So I think the two things would be to find a way to translate your volunteer experience into skills and responsibilities that an employer will understand as being meaningful on the job. And the second is to make sure that you are up to date on social media and that kind of stuff, because that's a big part of any workplace today.
Well, and Paula, good luck to you. And thank you very much for your Facebook comment. And we do need to close it out now. So Mary Jo, just the super quick last word from you.
Yeah, I think that the world is changing around us, and ultimately the woman as caretaker and the male as breadwinner stereotype is being busted up. So I hope we can create workplaces that reflect this change.
All right, both of you. Thank you so much for being with us. And we're going to check in now very quickly with our summer car raffle.